Hi, I'm Vanessa Winter, and I am the co-writer and co-director of Deadstream.
I am Joseph Winter. I'm the co-writer, co-director, and the star of Deadstream, and you're listening to The Graveyard Show.
Welcome to The Graveyard.
And welcome to another edition of the Graveyard Show podcast. I am your caretaker, and the graveyard is open. Well, I think that board games have become all the new rage again. Back when I was just a young caretaker, board games were everything because, well, video games were still in their infancy. We had Atari, and we had, you know, early days of Commodore computers and stuff like that. I actually remember a time before there was really any video games. When I first got Atari, and there was that awesome game Pong that you would just sit there and play for hours, and then when Pac-Man came out, that was such a big deal. I mean, I couldn't wait to get that thing home and play. So, that changed everything. But of course, when you watch shows like Stranger Things and any shows that go retro 80s, the Dungeons and Dragons game always comes up. As a matter of fact, we just had a major motion picture that just came out, Dungeons and Dragons. And it's what we always say, what's old is new again. And that's certainly the case when it comes to board games. Now, last podcast, I had mentioned to you that there was a Halloween board game that was coming out later this year. And our friends at Fright Rags sent out an email regarding a Kickstarter for Halloween 2, the game. And it simply says, in this retro tabletop game based on the 1981 horror movie Halloween 2, players try to stop Michael Myers from killing Laurie Strode. Now, this is not the first time Fright Rags has gotten into the board game. And they're doing it again here. And I thought I would just kind of go through some quick bullet points on this retro-style tabletop game. So, yes, it is based on the movie, and it has the box cover that they're using is the famous Michael with the blood running down his eyes on the top part of it, and then below is Haddonfield Hospital, and then Laurie on the ground crawling towards it. So it comes with two Kickstarter-exclusive expansion packs. You have a double-sided game board, and I'm just going through this right now. So basically, the objective says Michael Myers has just been shot 6 times by Dr. Loomis and is on his way to Haddonfield Memorial Hospital to kill Laurie Strode. Your only goal is to stop Michael from reaching the hospital. Sounds simple, but not that easy. You get to play as your favorite characters, Dr. Loomis, Nurse Karen, Jimmy, Mrs. Elrod. Okay, Mrs. Alves, or actually I think it would probably be Nurse Alves, right? She was the head of nursing, I believe, in the movie. And Sheriff Brackett. Those are some of the characters. And then I guess there are 8 more characters in the exclusive expansion pack number 1. 2 more Michaels will be included if stretch goal number 7 is reached. See below. Okay, so this is the email that they sent out. It looks like there are 3 difficulty levels. I mean, this is incredible what they've included in this email. Collect weapons, face obstacles, you draw fun cards. This is really, really cool. Kickstarter exclusives. The below expansion packs are only available to our Kickstarter backers and are already included in the main game box. No add-ons needed. So the other 8 players are, Laurie Strode and Bud, Marion Chambers, oh yes, Alice, Mr. Garrett, our favorite security guard, Nurse Jill, Dr. Mixter, and Janet. So they're your additional 8. I will let you go find this at Fright Rags. It's Fright Rags' website. I'm sure they're going to have this on there for a little bit more. Kickstarter's running out soon, but man, take a look at this. This is incredibly impressive. It looks like $59. One game includes both expansions For $99, you get two games, includes two sets of expansions, and then for $149, three games, includes three sets of expansions. So check it out at Fright Rags. Ironically enough, my previous podcast, I had John Cohn on the program. He's an author, but he's also a game designer for board games. And we talked about designing board games on that podcast. So if it's something that you're interested in, take a look. Go one podcast back, and you can find it there. And if you are playing any of these games, I would love to know your thoughts. You can either leave comments below if you're watching this online, or you can email the show at gyspodcast@gmail.com. That is gyspodcast@gmail.com. Now, as you heard at the top of the show, Joseph and Vanessa Winter will be joining me in just a moment to discuss their film Deadstream, which will be available at Walmart in an exclusive Steelbook Blu-ray starting July 18th. Now, on the other side of this interview, I'm going to talk about my latest upload to the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel. Catacombs of Horror's latest episode is up and available. And on the other side of this interview, I will get into what it is. But as you hear in the background, a new grave, or in this case, graves, are being added. And when that happens, it means my guests are here, and it's time for me to get to work. Joining me now is the co-writing, co-directing team of the film Deadstream, Joseph and Vanessa Winter. Joseph is also the star of the film. Deadstream will be available in an exclusive Steelbox Blu-ray at Walmart starting on July 18th, and it's great welcoming Joseph and Vanessa to the Graveyard Show podcast. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, it's great having you here. Your film is incredibly impressive, and I want to get into the nuts and bolts of making the film in just a moment. But Vanessa, I'll start with you first. Why don't you tell everyone out there what your film Deadstream is about?
Oh, let's see. Deadstream is about a disgraced YouTuber who tries to win back his followers by spending one night alone in a haunted house. And while he's doing that, he pisses off some pretty mean ghosts.
Pretty simple. it's very timely. Joseph, as far as sort of the cancel culture that we now live in, how much did that play into the story for you? And at what point did you decide that that's what you needed to kind of as the hook for the to get to the haunted house?
Well, originally, and this was several years ago, because we were stewing on this idea for a very long time. The character of Sean was just, he was a very friendly, happy guy, and his whole angle was, it's fun to see him scared, but there was no edge to him. There was no controversy. And this was at the time there were no other live stream movies. And then we started looking into YouTuber culture, and PewDiePie had his first big controversy. And we saw the fallout from that, how he responded, the apology video, and how that sort of became a thing. And we just thought that's actually more interesting for the story, as if Sean is coming fresh off the heels of something like that. Now that's pretty much a given if you're gonna do a live streaming or influencer movie. It seems like that's just a given part of it. At the time, though, for us, it seemed like a big revelation that this is what's going to make this guy more interesting.
Yeah, and what I love is how as the movie progresses, you're kind of stuck by having to do things because you may be canceled again or you may lose your sponsorship. There's a wonderful consequence to Sean backing out and this fear of losing his show again.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, just the idea of relevancy and the anxiety around it, I think definitely you can feel that in the YouTuber influencer culture. But I think that Joseph and I were able to tap into it a little bit as filmmakers, and I think other artists feel this too, which is, if you lose your relevancy, you lose your ability to make money.
Yeah.
And so it does. I mean, we definitely played it up with Sean's character as it felt very life or death to him. So there's an exaggeration there, but I think that on a smaller level, other people can relate to that.
I think, and I honestly think it's any artist who is actively pursuing a professional career in the arts, I feel like there is some kind of disposition, even if they don't want to admit it, there's some kind of disposition to wanting your work to have an audience and to have some kind of validation. And in our movie, it's like we were kind of pinning that on influencers, like, look, they just need attention, but we're not influencers. We're not interested in that space. However, we still have those feelings and we still have that fear of like making a thing and there isn't an audience for it. Nobody cares. And I feel like I personally think that that's something that probably a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah, and I think we really pushed it with Sean, though. For Sean, if he loses that, he'd rather be dead than lose his relevancy.
That's true. I don't think I have that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely comes across, and that's what I love about it. There's so much. What I enjoy about your first-person film is that it's one of the few first-person films that actually makes sense in terms of shooting it. Because you now have a culture like we were just talking about, like this online culture, influencers culture, where people are shooting themselves with their phones and they're just putting stuff out there. And with yours, it makes so much sense because we're stuck with Sean in this haunted house and we're seeing what you're seeing, Joseph, and we're also seeing your reaction. And it all makes sense. And that's always my problem with a lot of first person films is that, as much as it's supposed to be a documentary or a faux documentary, you still have to see what's going on. Otherwise, the audience isn't going to know what's happening. And that's what I love about your film. So when you started planning it, was that one of those things that you just thought, like, maybe our story just is perfect as a first-person movie?
We did put quite a bit of thought into it. And I wish our DP was here to talk about it with us because he was a big part of the brainstorming. But it was really important to us that the film had a cinematic aspect to it where the cameras weren't too shaky and you could see what was going on. And at the same time, we were trying to balance that with it feeling like it had an authenticity of, well, there's a guy wearing all of these cameras. In reality, it was very, very staged and crafted on set, where the DP was running in and adjusting all the cameras and gimbals and stuff in between, and we had to break things up. So I was, because of all the problems we had, I was very happy with how kinetic the film feels. But in order to, yeah, I think I'm answering your question, get the framing really
precise.
Yeah, precise, and be it to feel like a moving story. It was pretty composed.
We made the conscious decision really early on that we did not want this to look like a regular found footage movie, not because it was above that, because that's great for most found footage movies, but because we wanted to be a Evil Dead 2 kind of experience by the end. And the only way to pull that off is to make a cinematic promise at the beginning. And that's why we worked into the character that Sean is also passionate about that. So he's promising the most cinematic experience in live streaming. So that we could kind of get away with doing that with like a ridiculous amount of camera setup and this like infrastructure in place that you can at some point in the movie hopefully take a step back, kind of forget you're watching a live stream and just enjoy it more like a classically shot film.
Yeah. That being said, the DP and I had a lot of conversations about if we were doing a live stream, how would we do it? And so the way that Sean sets up the cameras and kind of his process and his gear bags and everything he brings with him, that was also inspired by us thinking, we're going to do this for realsies. How do we do it?
Yeah.
It felt incredibly authentic. And if I didn't see the credits at the end of the movie, I would have sworn this was done with just a handful of you and with Joseph going in. I mean, I kind of thought for a minute, like, I wonder if they kind of like did guerrilla filmmaking here where they set everything up and then just had Joseph go in and do like Blair Witch, where it was like things were going to happen without you really knowing what it was going to be. And then I'm looking at this, I'm like, man. And then you see the credits, I'm like, no, it's a movie. I mean, it's, you know, this is a full feature that's being shot. So you guys did an amazing job putting this together. I mean, I'll be honest, if you wanted to, you probably could have put this out there as one of those this really happened kind of movies and just kind of gotten a reaction, because that's how good it is and authentic it is, because you feel everything. You feel, I mean, Joseph, obviously, as the star of the movie, I mean, you really convey so much fear and confusion. I mean, you're going through all of these emotions, and it felt real. And seeing when you have, I don't want to give too much away for people who haven't seen it, but when you're in the car and something's trying to get you, it feels incredibly real. So as the one with the cameras and the mount, how conscious did you have to be while acting to make sure that the camera was getting what you needed it to get?
That was honestly the hardest thing of the entire shoot, was having to be aware of that and not being able to just get into the character and react. So anytime I would start to lose myself in a monologue or whatever, the emotional moment of the story, it was suddenly like, we got to cut, because the cameras are going crazy. You can't see anything. And that was so frustrating. But eventually, I think I found the rhythm of like having a consciousness of like, don't you move your neck, freak out, but don't move your neck, you know? So that was very difficult. It was something that I don't know that I will ever experience again, just because I think it's not really required of acting in general. And I don't think I'd ever recommend that to somebody, because I think those are two parts of your brain that aren't supposed to communicate.
Well, how heavy was the gear?
It was super, it was very uncomfortable. But I do want to say this, rather than just complaining about how heavy it was, I want to say Jared Cook, our DP and producer, who was responsible for the gear and everything that I was wearing, he did so much to make sure it was as comfortable as it possibly could be. And I know for sure this is as possible as it possibly could be. And it was still very, very heavy, and at times could be pretty excruciating.
I will say this, that I did wear it for a few shots for pickups. And I remember taking it off after 15 minutes being like, oh, I've got a headache. And so, yeah, those must have been long days.
Well, yeah, I can't even imagine, because I know, like, you know, for Steadicam operators, you know, people think that they're so light, and I've seen professional athletes put those things on and almost fall over. They're so heavy. And if you don't have the balance right.
They're horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt for you, Joseph, watching this, because I'm like, dude's running, dude's banging into stuff, he's hiding, and I can't even imagine. I just can't even imagine how much water you had to drink and how much calorie burning that was.
So here's the thing. If you pay attention, I actually lose a significant amount of weight at different parts of the movie. We didn't shoot it in order, but there's a weight fluctuation, there's a facial hair fluctuation, there's like a lot of stuff going on there in just 80 minutes of real time.
Well, maybe there's a new diet book out there where you can do the Deadstream diet. Yeah, exactly. So Vanessa, let's talk about this as far as the tech goes, because you have Joseph's gear that he's wearing, then you have the cameras that he's setting up in certain points of the house. On top of that, you have the iPad or the tablet that he's using. While you're having, at least I would think at some point live, he's getting live messages so he can react off of that. So how involved was the planning, putting this whole thing together?
Yeah, it was pretty terrifying. It seemed like such a good idea on the page. And then when it came to executing it, we started realizing how technical it was. Again, our amazing DP and producer, Jared Cook, he actually constructed the interface of the iPad so that we could get those shots in camera rather than doing them in post-production.
Wow.
But there were some times on set where we'd be in a big hurry and we'd play back, you know, a pre-made video or a pre-made scene within the iPad and realize the timing wasn't matching up. Because a lot of times Sean is looking at cameras of himself from one of the IR cameras in the house. And so anyway, we would actually scramble, stop shooting, reshoot the IR camera. Jared would go put it on his computer and then re-export it into the Libid interface and then
load that back up
yeah. to the iPad, and we do it again. Wow. So yeah, it did get a little tricky.
But fortunately, I don't know if you had read this somewhere already, but we shot it. We did 7 days of principal photography back to back, and then the rest of it was shot over many months, just on weekends here and there. So, I mean, we had to. We got into a point where we're like, guys, we're going to have to shift into this kind of shooting where people pop in on the weekends, like just as many as we could get to come. And sometimes it was just three of us. And we'd go in and do these pickups to like get some of this stuff right, because it just wasn't working out on set like as intended originally.
Wow. That is amazing. You did 7 days and then just pickups after that? That's incredible. I mean, there a movie like this could have taken months to make. I mean, it's so intricate. That is incredible. I mean, was it one of those things where, like, Vanessa, could you talk to Joseph while he was in the house? Did you have like an IFB or like something that you could talk? Or was it more of those like you talk, you leave, you go to Video Village, he shoots, you know, and then you kind of come back? How did that work?
Sometimes it was easier than other times. There are some scenes where I could just be on the other side of the wall in a different room with Video Village. But there were the exteriors, I remember, were particularly frustrating because there's a long walk for Sean, and then he has to break into the house and there's spider webs and stuff that have to be reset on each take. And it was a long walk back to Video Village. Plus, there was lots of debris on the ground in the dark.
That's always
fun.
There were some
bad miscommunications. There were some me yelling from the first floor of the house to the second floor of the house.
Yeah. Because I look at that and I go, well, at first I thought, I went back to, this is a real house, to, oh, maybe they're on stage, back to, no, this is a real house. So where did you find this house, and where'd you shoot it?
So when we wrote the script, we were very aware that we were writing something impossible for us to film, because our parameters were, this needs to be something that we can film with just a handful of friends and most likely self-funded. So that would mean it would need to be close to our house, but we know of no house like this that's designed this way, that's in the woods. But we went for it anyway, and I put out a Facebook call of like, does anybody know of any house like this? And people started nominating this abandoned pioneer home in this small town that's about 30 minutes away from us. But they also said, no one will ever let you film there because it gets broken into so much. But fortunately, they did. We were able to work something out with them. And the cool thing is, it's out in the middle of these open fields, so certainly not surrounded by forest, but it just so happens to have a patch of thick, tall trees on one side of it, just a little cluster. And we were able to, at night, shoot through those trees to the house and then cheat the other angles with a forest that's a few miles away and make it look like it was an abandoned house in the forest. So it really ended up working out perfectly. But it was like, again, we did not expect that we could even do the movie as written.
Wow. It looked great. And it's one of those things where I look at a movie like this and I go, if this is a regular shot movie, I guess this is called, if it was a non-first person a movie, I think it would have different beats how things would play. But in this case, as we're coming from your perspective going through the house, did you consciously try to come up with where the jump scares would be versus not? Did you at some point go, well, we'll let the house kind of be... let that just be scary on its own while people are waiting for something to come out? Like, how conscious were you of putting that together and not getting crazy with the jump scares? Because I'll tell you, the jump scares that you had in it, I mean, there was one that I like jumped off the couch. It was so perfect.
Yeah. yeah, I would say both. Yeah, there was a realization in I would say the first 20 minutes of the film, Joseph and I were having some anxiety about not enough scares happening. But we started to trust the character of the house, that it was interesting enough and scary enough that it was actually a great way to suck the audience into the universe. And then as far as the actual scares, they were very, I mean, like I said before, it was very composed and premeditated. So there are some shots where I had a stopwatch to make sure that the film wouldn't get too long or wouldn't lag. So when it came to the timing of things jumping out or ghost attacks, they were just, yeah, they were super rehearsed, and we messed around a lot with the timing in rehearsals. We filmed some rehearsals to make sure that we could get it right.
Joseph, I mentioned, we've talked about how physical the role was for you. Did you have to really get in condition before doing this, or was it kind of learning on the job? I can't imagine that at the end of the day you were feeling very good.
Well, it was the plan to get in shape for it. Like, it was, I was going to train. I knew a guy that trained athletes, and he started creating a plan for me, and it just didn't work out. There wasn't time. We were also producing it with Jared and Melanie, and there was just so much to do in such a short amount of time that just fell by the wayside. And and also, so did rehearsing. Like, so I had these plans, not rehearsing. We ended up rehearsing a lot. Once we had the location, we shot a lot of the movie during the day, trying to like rewrite it and figure it out. But leading up to it, I had planned on taking a lot of me time to develop the character and my connection with the character. There was no time for that. So, and it showed on the rehearsals for sure, and on the first couple of days, that I had not been able to prep in that way. And so we had to pop in, do some reshoots on those first couple of days and parts where you really notice. But eventually I found the character, we found the character together, and it all worked out. But man, yeah, I was not physically in shape for what I was doing as intended.
Yeah, Joseph's also being hard on himself. He did a lot of character prep, and yeah.
Well, you can tell.
I'm just talking about my plans for myself.
Right, yeah, there were because of the producer-director roles, the acting prep time kind of got the boot.
Sure, I'm sure. It's a lot. I mean, your performance is great in it. It really is. I mean,
oh, thank you.
Incredibly admirable. I'm watching this thing going, man, wow, I could not have done that.
That's very nice of you.
Yeah, no, you did great work. And I also love, too, the opening where you show clips of your online show. So was that one of those over time you kind of went out and just kind of found different areas and put stuff together? Because some of the stuff you do in those is insane.
Yeah, we put a lot into that because it was so important for us to start the movie off with something that you believed existed in the world. Like, we wanted to show enough stunts and enough variety over different seasons that you feel instantly, oh, this exists. This is like a person who has had a career doing this kind of thing. But do you want to talk about some of the stuff we had to do for it?
I'm just thinking about the timeline. We shot the dog sledding stuff very first. So it's interesting because that was the first thing that gave us the feeling of, oh, we're making this movie. And then I think the baby Moses gag was the last thing that we shot. And I was really pregnant. And it was like this feeling of, are we not done with this movie yet?
No, dude, because it was so long. It was so long after Principal that we were like going to the river. We had made this dummy for a stunt shot, and like we had a glue gun, and we were making this raft in our house that we bought from Amazon, like gluing this stuff, and we're like, what are we doing, man? And you're like pregnant as freak, and we're still making this thing. And but anyway, yeah,
at the same time, they were kind of the funnest parts. Don't you think?
I think a couple of them.
I mean, I wasn't in the rap, so.
Well, it looks so authentic. It really does. Do either or both of you believe in ghosts?
I know enough people who have had experiences that I believe the people, and I don't know what it is that they're experiencing, but I believe them that they're experiencing something. And that's as far as, like, that's as far as I've concluded on it.
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical, but I, at the same time, I think the unexplained is so fun that there has to be part of me that's open to the paranormal.
We have a 4-year-old daughter who, this was 2 days ago, she literally said, I was going to talk to you about this. She literally said, we're in the car, she's like, Dad, Mom said that you believe in ghosts. Is that a real conversation you had recently?
I don't remember that.
Oh, because I told her, I said, I'm skeptical, but I think they're possible. And she's like, no, Mom told me you do believe in ghosts.
There you go. Well, you certainly made a movie that convinced me that you do. What is next on the horizon for the two of you?
We've got more horror in the pipeline. We're not allowed to announce anything specifically, but...
But there's a thing that I think, if you do like Deadstream and the tone of our VHS 99 segment, I feel like people will be excited once we're able to talk about it. It's something that I'm really thrilled to be part of.
Great. Well, we can't wait, and I would love to definitely have you back when that project is out and ready to go. And I love the fact that Deadstream is on Shudder, so for those of you that have Shudder, you can pop it on and watch it there. And more importantly, starting July 18th, Deadstream will be available exclusively at Walmart in the Steelbook Blu-ray. Thank you both, Joseph and Vanessa. Thank you both for being here on the Graveyard Show podcast. This was really a great conversation. Love the movie, and wish you guys all the best, and love to have you back on in the near future.
We'd love to come back. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And as I put this interview to rest, I want to again thank Vanessa and Joseph for joining me here on the show. It was really great talking to them about their film. It's a really well-done movie, and there's a lot going on in this film, and I was really looking forward to talking to them about the nuts and bolts of making this movie. So again, you can find it on Shudder, and starting on July 18th, it will be exclusively available in Walmart in a Steelbook Blu-ray edition. Now, Catacombs of Horror, my latest video production. The latest episode just uploaded just a few days ago. Something I've been working on, and it actually wasn't the original idea I was going to do. Originally, I was going to do this Catacombs of Horror on my favorite scenes from the film Blackula, which I've been talking about for a while on these podcasts. But I had a change of heart, because after I saw Evil Dead Rise... Evil Dead was kind of just, I was thinking about it a lot, and not just the movie, but I was thinking about the franchise overall. So when I started obsessing over that, I had to do a Catacombs of Horror on it, because that's all I was thinking about. And this edition of Catacombs of Horror is simply asks, is Evil Dead the best horror movie franchise of all time? Simple question. I put it up against five other movie franchises, and I'm not going to tell you which five because I want you to go and watch the video. So I match up these six franchises, and I set up guidelines so it would be a fair contest to see which of these six is the best horror movie franchise of all time. Now, I know there's some of you out there that are like, wait, six? There's like, you know, 500 movie franchises. Yes, that's correct. That's why you have to see what the movie guidelines were that I set up to have these franchises evenly matched going into this battle. So you can check that out on the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com and you can look up the handle at Graveyard Show Podcast. That is at Graveyard Show Podcast. And you can find that as well as the other episodes of Catacombs of Horror. My favorite scenes from Count Yorga Vampire, my favorite scenes from The Return of Count Yorga Vampire, as well as my favorite scenes from Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, and why That movie, I feel, is the second most important movie in the Halloween series, and a missed opportunity that the series had that it whiffed on. It should have gone in a certain direction, and it didn't. And also, 1980s horror. The director of the In Search of Darkness documentaries, David Weiner, joins me on the show to talk about 1980s horror, and he and I both pick what we think best represents 1980s horror in four different categories. So Catacombs of Horror you can find on the Graveyard Show podcast YouTube channel. You can also find the other video production I do called The Caretaker Reveals, where I show you a piece of memorabilia from the world of horror or sci-fi. They're very short. They're only a couple minutes long. I've done one on, going back to Count Yorga, the Count Yorga Blu-ray collection, as well as the Amusement Park Blu-ray. I show you some of the Fright Rags t-shirts that I own, in case you're curious what they look like, and several other videos as well. You can also find this podcast, the Graveyard Show podcast, on the YouTube channel, as well as the GYS classics that I upload. You can also find the old BC's Video Vault segments from the original Graveyard Show podcast of 2009 and 10. You have the George A. Romero wing, the In Search of Darkness wing, a whole lot of stuff you can find there, as well as old promos from podcasts from days gone by, as well as old promos for this show as well. So I invite you to join me on YouTube, Graveyard Show Podcast on YouTube, and that's where I'm spending most of my time. This year, I wanted to make that happen, and if you look here for the podcast this year, they're not as many as they were in previous years. That is done on purpose because I find I can do a lot more online. You can also find trailers to movies and books as well on there, something that I just started doing a few months ago. So you can find a lot on the Graveyard Show Podcast YouTube channel. All right, my friends, it's hot. It's the peak of summer, so I'm going to just close everything down. Let's get inside to some AC. It's too hot out here. All right, enjoy the rest of your summer. And as you exit the graveyard, I would like to remind you to please lock the gate behind you. We wouldn't want anyone to get out. Until next time.